I was pretty confident that I wasn't burning any bridges back home and I could always just go back to how things were, but it felt like an opportunity that I couldn't resist.
Welcome to the Freedom Lifestyle podcast series, a series that is so much more than just a podcast series. This is a movement towards freedom in life and in work, and about taking a lifestyle you know you deserve. I'm your host, Sam, and I have always admired working where you want, when you want, and how you want. Just like my guests, I've found my version of the freedom lifestyle, and I'm sharing all the secrets for how you can too. The freedom lifestyle looks different for everyone. What's your free? You're listening to another episode of the Freedom Lifestyle podcast series. It's so great to be back in your ears after this little break. I promise you are going to love this episode. I actually recorded it almost 2 months ago, and not to pump myself up too much, but I forgot actually how amazing this conversation was. You are going to love this guest. So the story here is when I first got back from my 4 month trial of living like a digital nomad and backpacking with my laptop across South America, I came home and I was determined to sustain this lifestyle and really become a digital nomad and do this more long term. So the biggest thing stopping me was that I needed consistent revenue streams for myself so that I could be away consistently and be totally location independent. And I didn't always want to be working all the time while I was traveling, so I really wanted to create passive income. As you know, I've been teaching Launch a Podcast on a Budget. It's a workshop that I've been teaching in person in Toronto. I taught it a number of times over the last year, and I even recently taught it once in Vancouver, which was amazing. But I knew that this was something that I could take online, launch my first online course, and create a passive income stream for myself. But I'd never created an online course before. I had no idea how to work a camera or what type of lighting and editing and all that stuff was required and what it took to be successful. So I took my first online course, very meta, called How to Launch an Online Course on Udemy. And this is how I discovered today's guest. So Louise Croft, you can find her on Instagram at Digital Nomad Girl. She's actually a full-time Udemy instructor and has been a digital nomad for more than 5 years. She's been doing this way before it became mainstream. And I took her course and I got so much out of it and totally actually fell in love with her as well. Her vibe was so aligned with freedom lifestyle that I just followed her on Instagram and kind of just kept following her posts while I worked away at building my online course. I'm very proud to say that my course is now live. It went live this week. And if you check it out, you can go to launchapodcast.com. If you're interested in taking the course, I'm offering 50% off until Saturday, September 21st with code LAUNCHWEEK. And honestly, I owe a lot of this and being able to bring this idea to life to today's guest, Louise. Her insights in her course were amazing, and she's just a really impressive person. So I reached out to her, I asked her to be a guest on the show, and she said yes. Over the last few months of quote unquote knowing her, aka stalking her online, I've seen her travel to Dubai, England, Bali. I think now she's in Tokyo for her birthday. She was in Australia. Honestly, she's the coolest. She's doing all of this with her husband. They're both digital nomads. And she's a full-time course instructor on Udemy. She also has a YouTube channel. And in this episode, we talk about how she quit her job back in England and transitioned her skills to become an online worker and remote worker so that she can work anywhere in the world. We talk about what her life is like now, how they spend their day-to-days. We also talk about the sacrifices that she's had to make to actually have this lifestyle and what she's given up in order to be a digital nomad. So it's an amazing episode. If you are interested in what this digital nomad lifestyle is like, or if you're curious about online courses and selling courses online on platforms like Udemy or even one of your own. She also gave great tips for how to be successful, how to come up with courses that you can teach, and what you should look for from a production standpoint. You are going to love this episode. Louise, welcome to the Freedom Lifestyle Podcast.
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to be asked. It was so cool. I've been following along on your Instagram and everything you've got going on, and I am a major podcast addict. So I'm always excited to be able to listen to one and discover new places.
Amazing. Well, now you get to be on one too. And I know you've been on some podcasts before, so hopefully this will be a little bit different and fun for you too.
Yeah, totally. They're always different. It's always cool to see what people ask. So I love it.
Well, I always like to ask people who are digital nomads, remote workers, this question first, which is, where in the world are you taking this interview from?
Well, right now I'm in Brisbane in Australia. It's pretty late at night. It's like going on for 10 p.m. So I'm sat on the floor to make sure I get a good, nice, soft sound with the carpet. There's no echo. So it's all very glamorous.
Oh, wow. Amazing. And you're not originally from there, right? You're from England?
Yeah. I'm British originally.
And is this your first time in Australia, or is this, are you finally checking off your bucket list, or is this somewhere you often go?
No, we've actually been here several times. I came here when I was about maybe like 8 years old with my parents. My parents are super cool. They were big into travel, and they actually took me out of school for 2 months back when you could do that. Now you get in big trouble if you do that. But anyway, when we did that like 20 years ago, they took us out of school and we caravanned all around Australia. And I just totally fell in love. And you can see then in all my schoolwork for like the next 10 years are just all about Australia. Like every project was all about Australia, and it was just like my dream. And then last year, my husband and I were on a government program here called Hot Desk, where they get foreign companies to move to Australia to like set up here and try and grow the startup ecosystem locally. So that was really cool. So came here for 6 months with a bunch of other amazing international entrepreneurs, and we had an awesome time, and we got to meet loads of really cool local startups. And then we went back to the UK because we were getting married, so we had to go back. But now, a year later, we've come back to Brisbane again. And we're starting some different companies with people that we met on the program and people who are based here. And it's all going on, but we're so glad to be back in Brisbane. We just love it here.
I did Australia in 2011 or 12, and it's such an amazing place to travel. And my favorite, I think, was Melbourne. Is that how I pronounce it right? Melbourne. Yeah.
Well, Melbourne's really cool. I feel like it's very English. It's very like trendy. There's loads of good food. Everyone's really nice. The problem we had with Melbourne is that it has the English weather. They have proper seasons. They have rain. and Brisbane just doesn't have any of that. So right now it's like deepest, darkest winter, and it's just 20 degrees every day. And we're so amused because all the locals are like, it's so cold. Everyone's wearing big coats. And all the marketing is like, oh, we're doing sweet potato soup to like warm you up, and we're just like, what are you talking about? It's 20 degrees. So we're absolutely loving it. In fact, this weekend we went ice skating. They had like an outdoor ice skating rink, and I was wearing factor 50 sun cream. I was like, I'm gonna get burnt ice skating. This is mad.
So they really take their winters seriously.
I guess it's novelty for them. We're just like always trying to escape winter, but this is the perfect balance for us.
Yeah, that's the same here in Canada, right? We have all four seasons as well, and winter can be pretty brutal. I try to get away if I can as well. So you mentioned your family bringing you to Australia. Is that when you started getting hooked on travel? Do you remember when you first discovered digital nomading and this came on your radar?
Yeah, Australia was my first like big trip as a kid, and it just totally blew my mind. And my parents made us do like some maths and English, and we kept a diary and stuff, but mostly we were out of school. And I remembered really understanding that I was learning so much more than I would have learned in school. And like, it was different things. And I was always very academic, so I went back and like threw myself back into school. But I always remember thinking I discovered so much on that trip. And like, as a child, it really opened up my eyes. So then I was always really into travel. Like, I had a gap year. I did a bunch of trips to, you know, like India, Thailand, Cambodia, Peru, all those kind of things, kind of while I was studying and all that stuff. And then when I graduated, I started a kind of a startup, I guess, involved in secondhand clothes. But my boyfriend, who's now my husband, was becoming a nomad without realizing it. And he was a developer. So he was living in London, but it was really expensive. So he decided to go to Estonia, and then he went to San Francisco for a bit. And he was kind of just moving around to save money. And then when he said he was going to Thailand, and he, like, we discovered it was called being a digital nomad, I was like, I want to do this. Like, so I quit my job, I quit startup that I was doing, and we both moved to Thailand together. And we moved to Chiang Mai because we read online it was the place to go. And then kind of the rest is history. That was, I don't know, like, I guess 4 years ago, probably, maybe five.
Wow. And what kind of work were you doing before? Was it a big deal for you to quit it? Was it something that you had really invested in, or was it an easy decision?
So I'd been involved in secondhand clothes with a charity for about a year, straight out of university, and I really loved it. I'd basically invented my dream job, which was like being a consultant, I guess, for thrift shops. So I went in and I did this like big Pinterest interior design in the shops, and then I was helping them. I have a business degree, so I was helping them kind of be a better business, like working out the pricing and the staffing and all those kind of things, and organizing events like fashion shows and concerts in the shops. And I was having a really awesome time, but I'd been in it for a year and I'd redone several shops by that point, and it was starting to get a bit repetitive. Even though every shop was different, the process was kind of the same. And I knew I wanted to travel, and I knew I wanted to run my own thing, and I was doing that, but it was kind of, I guess it was more like freelance work. So I was working with one charity as a kind of contractor, so they weren't my boss, but they had influence over me. And yeah, when Ed said he was going to Thailand, I was like, I just can't turn this down. But I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do for work. I just thought, I'll have to work it out when I get there.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like an amazing job. The role that you had before, that must have been really difficult to say goodbye to. And I know you do fashion blogging and you have a really awesome YouTube channel. Had this already happened yet, or did this happen later?
So I was already doing my blog, which was just all about secondhand clothes. So it was like an ethical fashion blog. I don't think I was doing YouTube at that point, but when I did start my YouTube, it was about secondhand clothes as well. And then once I was a year or two into nomad life and I realized I was more interested in talking about that than about clothes anymore, and I thought it would make more of an impact. You know, I love promoting sustainable shopping, but I felt like I could give back to people in an even bigger way if I could help them learn how to become a nomad and like answer their questions really transparently. So that's when my YouTube kind of pivoted to becoming Digital Nomad Girl, rather than before it was Pauper to Princess, which was all about like secondhand fashion.
It sounds like you went all in. Like, for me and my experience with transitioning to digital nomading, it's very much been a transition. Mm-hmm. Like, last year I went on a few trips. This year I went traveling for 4 months, came back home, kept my apartment. Mm-hmm. We'll be traveling again for 3 months in the fall. Like, did you go completely all in? Like, you moved
to
Thailand?
Yeah, I was quite lucky in a way in that the charity I was working with was in my hometown, and I was only a year out of university. So I was just living with my parents. So I didn't have to like sell my house or sell my car, or I just left all my stuff in my bedroom at my parents and just went off to Thailand. And the way that we did it is that we just booked I think it was 3 months round trip. So it was like September time. So we booked a return trip to be home for Christmas. And I just thought, we'll give it a go. We'll go to the number one place and we'll speak to people and we'll see how it is. And if we don't like it, then it's a shorter trip than I've done just backpacking. So no one will even notice. It won't feel like a failure. I'll just come home after 3 months and be like, I'll have my own job back, or I'll get a different job. And I was pretty confident that I wasn't burning any bridges back home and I could always just go back to how things were. But it felt like an opportunity that I couldn't resist.
And it sounds like that isn't what happened, because you're still going today. How long ago was this that you made the move to Thailand?
I think it was at least 4, maybe 5 years. It was a pretty long time ago.
Wow. So you were pretty early in this. Like, now, like, I'm still educating people about what a digital nomad is 5 years ago. I can't even imagine what type of questions you got and concerns, maybe, if that was 5 years ago and you said you were doing this.
Yeah, it's so funny now. Whenever people say, you know, just strangers on the street, like, oh, what's your job? I give a variety of different answers depending on the mood I'm in. But normally I kind of say like, oh, you know, we work and travel or something like that. And now people say like, oh, you mean you're a digital nomad? And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? Do you know what this is? And it's really cool to hear how many people know about it now and how many people are like a step ahead. It's amazing to see how much it's grown, how much it's changed.
And it's also so true about not knowing how to answer that question.
I know.
I feel like I tried really hard at the beginning, but then I just get myself in really uncomfortable conversations. And now I've just been saying I work online.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've been working online, which is just so vague. I don't think we're helping by just making it even more mysterious, but it is just kind of complicated if someone has never been exposed to it before. If someone's more entrepreneurial or maybe they're a freelancer, it's easier, but there is a gap to bridge here, at least in Canada. Have you been this way?
I have, yeah. I've only been to Toronto, but I'm planning on coming back to Canada next year because one of my friends lives in Alberta and he's like, you have to come to Stampede. So I'm going to go to Stampede and I don't know how it will go, but he says he's going to take me. I really want to go to Lake Louise, which maybe is kind of vain, but I want to get a picture of Louise at Lake Louise.
Oh,
so yeah, he's like, Canada's so beautiful. I'll show you around. So yeah, I'm hoping to come back next year, which will be awesome.
And how often are you and Ed, that's your husband, right?
Yeah.
How often are you two moving around now? Like, how are you approaching your digital nomad lifestyle 5 years later? I definitely want to talk about money and how you've sorted that, because I think that's a huge barrier for a lot of people. But just in terms of movement and adjusting, is it different all the time, or do you guys have some best practices now sorted?
Yeah, our preference is to move about every 3 months, but in reality, we quite often move more often. I guess just because of the way the dates fall. So we normally find if we're less than 2 months in a place, like if we're 1 month, then it's too hectic and we don't get to settle in properly. We don't get to make friends. We don't actually get to explore that much because you're just arriving and then you're leaving again. And obviously you're working as well. So I kind of think of each place that we're in, we normally spend like 1, maybe 2 days a week doing touristy stuff. So if we live somewhere for a month, then I kind of explain to people that we've visited there for 4 days. So it's like, you know, if we're in Brisbane for eight weeks, then if someone comes to me and they're like, oh, what's good to do in Brisbane? And I'm like, well, I went on essentially an 8-day trip to Brisbane. So I can tell you what's good to do for a week kind of thing. Because I think people think if we're here for 2 months, then we will have seen like absolutely everything. And the truth is we spend a lot of time working or going to our favorite restaurants or going to the gym and the kind of things that you don't do when you're on holiday. So yeah, so our preference is to move about every 3 months so that we have enough time to get settled in, but we also don't get too bored.
That makes sense. What's your favorite place that you've lived so far?
It's kind of cliched, but we do really love Chiang Mai. And like, I know everybody says that, but the community there is so good. And I haven't been back actually for a couple of years. We're going to go in a few months' time. So it'll be nice to see if it's changed, if it's still the same. But yeah, we always have a great time living in Chiang Mai because the community is just so, so good. And the setup is really good. There's really great restaurants. There's good places to work out. There's good places to work. Like, it's kind of just a ready-made like template.
Totally. And you keep saying community. So does that mean you're surrounding yourself with a lot of digital nomads when you're there? And if so, like, what is the profile of a digital nomad? Like, are there certain characteristics and traits that you've noticed about digital nomads after meeting so many?
Interesting. Good question. Yeah, I think there probably is. I think with every community in the world, you know, with like athletes or bloggers or models or whatever, there's going to be a mixture of people. Like, there's going to be cool people and like difficult people. So I think sometimes people have a bad image of digital nomads because they've met some of the ones who are scammy or whatever. But I think that's just true of any community group in the world, any interest group. So in general, the good sides of nomads are they're normally pretty relaxed, I find. Everybody's kind of like, who's up for dinner tonight? Like, oh, 20 people. That sounds great. People don't kind of plan too far ahead. people are obviously pretty entrepreneurial. They're very like, yes, people who are very proactive and get up and go. And people who are hardworking and motivated and quite brave, I suppose, like the kind of people who just break out of the status quo and like take the leap and move to Thailand or quit their jobs, or they're quite dreamers, I suppose. They're people who believe that like there's a better life out there, and they kind of don't accept just what they've been given as the template. So they're a pretty cool bunch, but I feel like we're pretty quite misfit. Like if you move to Thailand and kind of cut ties, like sell your house and sell all your stuff, then you're probably not like an easy fit in kind of dinner party guest. You're going to be a bit wild. And those are my people who are interesting and who want to do like thought experiments or start crazy businesses and kind of be experimental like that. But yeah, so I think we're kind of a bit misfits, but we all fit together.
I love that. Yeah, I feel like I fit that profile. I need to go to Chiang Mai. I have not been there, but I've heard amazing things in the digital nomad community. I recently did Playa del Carmen. Have you been there in Mexico?
I haven't.
Like another for North America, closer to Canada, where a lot of people go.
Yeah, any kind of hotspot, you'll have the same experience where just like anybody on a laptop, you're like, hey, are you a nomad? And everyone you meet is like in the same headspace as you. And I find, I guess because of that kind of profile I painted earlier, that everybody is kind of pre-filtered as your type of people. And obviously you don't have 100% hit rate of like, we're going to be best friends with everybody, but your hit rate's much better than just a stranger on the street. So it's cool that pretty much everyone you meet, you're like, oh, I could be best friends with this person.
And how do you define digital nomad? Because that's another thing I've been kind of feeling, you know, when you're trying to be part of a community, but mm-hmm. then some people have really strict definitions. Well, if you still have your place in Toronto, mm-hmm. you're not a digital nomad. Or if you're not living completely out of your backpack forever, then you're not a digital nomad. Like, how do you define it?
Yeah, I totally agree. I actually did a video about this recently just on that topic, just saying I think it should be inclusive. And what's the point in blocking people out of your squad, you know? I guess to me, there's a slight difference with location independent and digital nomad, because I feel like if we were to move back to the UK, we would still be doing the same job. Like we're not doing these jobs just because we have to so that we can travel. We're doing these jobs because they're fun and interesting and like challenging, and they've got growth potential and all those kind of things. So I think if we were just living in the UK and we had a house and a dog and two cars and whatever, then I guess I would say we're self-employed, like maybe location independent, because we don't have to be there for our work. But I kind of think to be a digital nomad, you should probably be traveling at least a bit, like more than someone who has a job. So I guess that means more than 4 weeks a year. But I think if you still have a house, or if you only go away for the winter, or if you only do 6 months in each place, so you just move twice a year, or if you move 20 times a year, I kind of think all of that should just all be included. If you have kids, if you work for a company but you're remote, I think all of that, you can call yourself a nomad if you want. I think everybody should be welcome.
Yeah, more inclusivity. I'm all about that too. It's like, I want to be part of the cool kids. Do I have to give up everything though?
Yeah, people get quite competitive though. A few of my friends are minimalism YouTubers, and they said actually the minimalist community can also be quite like that, like quite, I guess exclusive isn't the right word, but like kind of aggressive about whether or not you qualify. And I really don't want the nomad space to reach that point of being like critical of each other. It's just the whole point is we're all misfit, so can't we all just be friends?
Totally. Well, it's kind of like veganism. Like, I'm a vegan, and since dating my boyfriend who's been transitioning, he always says like, I'm 90% vegan. And yeah, at the beginning I was like, that's not vegan. Like, you are only 10%. And he's really opened my eyes to, we need to make it less intense. Like, you're in or you're out, because if we make it more inclusive to where people are at, then more people can try it and feel like, okay, I'm reducing my meat consumption, or okay, I'm starting a few side hustles that are online, like I'm working towards this.
Yeah.
But if we make it so extreme, then it'll only ever be for a few people.
Yeah. And that's been actually my exact experience with veganism, the same as your boyfriend, is that I used to think I can't be a vegan because of all these reasons, you know, I couldn't give it up forever and I wouldn't want to be, what if someone cooks me meat and I'm too shy to say I don't eat it? Or, you know, I had all these worries of, I can't make that big change, I don't want to join that community. And then I just suddenly realized I could just have like half my meals as vegan and then I would kill half as many animals. And I was like, why didn't I think of this before? it's like saying I don't give to charity because I can't afford to be a philanthropist. And it's like, well, just give $1. Like, that's cool. Then you can give $2. And so just that revelation really blew my mind. So that's what I do now. I eat vegetarian like probably 60% of the time. And it just never occurred to me that I could do that. I think it's so cool.
So we're talking about so many of the positives about being a digital nomad and who the type of person is, their misfits, their dreamers, mm-hmm. you're making a better life for yourself. What would you say some of the cons have been in the last 5 years that maybe they're not even relevant to you? Maybe it's so small that it doesn't matter, but what would you say are the other things that you'd want to consider?
Well, for me, a con is not being able to have a pet. And some people wouldn't care about this, but I really miss, like, always had a family dog, so I really miss having a pet. And I think if we ever stop in the future, that's something that I will be like immediately doing, is getting like at least one dog. So that's a downside for me for sure. And I think it depends as well how close you are to your family, in that how much you want to physically see them. So I speak to my family a lot, but of course it's not the same. And you know, you miss birthday parties, you miss funerals, you miss weddings, like, and you can choose to go to these things, like, you're in control of your own life. So of course, if there's someone's wedding that we really want to go to, then we'll stay around Europe for that summer to make sure we're not too far away, or all of these things are within your control. But the way that we've chosen to travel means that we do miss quite a few things like that. We only see our families a few times a year. So for me, that's a downside, but I think it could easily be customized to you, because the whole point is that you're building your own lifestyle. And the same with the dog, actually. I know a few nomads who have dogs, and it means that they stay within Europe and they do road trips, or they do like van life, or they get trains, or they have a really small dog because then you're allowed to take it on planes in your lap, or things like that. So I think all the downsides you can customize, but if you're doing like a kind of cookie cutter, typical digital nomad life, then those are some of the things I think will be a downside. And another one that I really often feel is the level of friendships. It's quite hard to build really deep relationships when you're moving a lot, because even if you're somewhere for 2 months, maybe they arrive 3 weeks in, so then you only have like 5 weeks left, and then it takes a while to actually become BFFs. And then you're kind of leaving again already. So although we do have some really deep friendships, because when you're both new in a country, you spend a lot of time together and you kind of go deeper more quickly, you are then leaving. So it can be difficult to build strong relationships.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And also your friendships back at home kind of get impacted. Like, I felt like that was a bit weird, me coming home for my 4 month trip, of you still want to be invited to everything, but you haven't said yes to the last like 12 RSVPs and people are starting to forget about you. It can be a bit awkward coming back for a visit.
Yeah, totally. And you haven't been to that like weekly quiz night or bingo or dance class or whatever. So you're missing out on those small touch points where you just kind of keep the friendship alive. So I make the effort to do Skype calls with my really close friends, but you know, it's not the same. And so I think those friendships do suffer, and your new friendships kind of blossom really quickly. And I kind of, if you think of them on a graph, they're just like massively exponential, like kind of taking over the ones who've been there for years. But I do find that my really good friends, when I go home, sometimes it's just like you were never gone. And that's kind of how you can tell a really good like friendship compatibility, is when you're just immediately back to your old self again.
I love that. You mentioned the dog. I love that you also said that, because I have a cat, and that has been a transition for me of, where's the cat going to go and is the cat good? So if I never had a pet, I would totally be in that same boat of just on the vision board, that dog when this all ends. My question for you is, so do you see yourself nomading forever, or how far are you planning until that time with the dog and whatever else comes with it?
I know. Well, right now we just plan like kind of 6 months ahead. So we know for the next 6 months we're traveling. After that, who knows? I try not to like overcommit myself too much, because I used to plan really far ahead. Like when I was 10 years old, I could have told you what I'd be doing at like 26 and 35 and 42 and like all these very precise numbers. And I find that the older I get, the less I plan, because the more I realize that things just change really fast. Like you meet someone who offers you this really cool opportunity and suddenly everything's changed. And becoming a nomad was kind of like that. I don't know, like Ed went to Tallinn just pretty much at random. and then we went to Thailand just on a whim, and we kind of didn't know all these things that it would unlock. And all the companies we've started have just been because we met someone at an event we weren't going to go to or whatever. So we know for the next 6 months we're carrying on traveling, and after that we'll see what we feel like.
Okay, so 6 months at a time.
Yeah.
That's great that he's also on board. I definitely think that that's a perk for me as well, that my boyfriend also quit his job and is on board with this.
Yeah.
I personally don't know how long I could do it if I was doing it on my own or in long distance. I think that would be challenging.
Yeah.
Like, do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the downsides I should have mentioned, is like finding a partner, I think, can be really difficult because you're meeting cool people all the time who you're really compatible with, and you know they have the same mindset. But it's hard if you're both nomads, because you meet someone and you really like them, but then after 3 weeks they're moving to a different country, and it's like, do you go as well? Like, that's a bit intense. But then otherwise it's over. And then if you do go with them, like, you probably shouldn't live with them, but you've gone there to be with them, so like that's also kind of weird. And it just feels like there's a lot of barriers to being able to build a romantic relationship if you're a nomad, because if you meet someone who's not a nomad, then that's difficult. And if you meet someone who is a nomad, then that's difficult. And that's if you can even find any female nomads at all. So I'm really fortunate to have gone into this together with Ed. And I think that is quite a challenge for nomads. To me, that's probably the biggest downside. But I'm just lucky that I wasn't exposed to that downside, I guess.
So true. Digital nomad dating. I feel like that could be a YouTube video if it hasn't, if you haven't already done that.
I think someone was making an app. There's definitely a Facebook page, I think.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me. All these smart online workers solving for it.
I know, that money.
You mentioned female digital nomad in one of your videos. I think I saw you call it bromads. Yeah. Can you elaborate on what it's like to be a female digital nomad?
So I wish I'd invented the word bromad. I don't know where I heard it from, but I think it's not so much like that now from what I've been experiencing more recently. But in the early days, it was very, well, I guess you can easily understand what bromad means, like kind of a typical like American guy in like a baseball cap and a vest in Thailand being like, bro, this is so great. All the Thai women love me, you know, and I'm making $1 million like selling online courses. Or,
oh my gosh.
You know, they've always got sunglasses on indoors, like that kind of crowd. And that was why I started my channel, because I felt like that's all that was on the internet. That's all I was seeing. And I was like, this doesn't represent me at all. And it doesn't represent all the people I've met. But I guess there's kind of a cause and effect where people who start channels are the people who maybe have a lot to gain from it if they're selling like a course or affiliates or something, or they're people who are very like publicly minded, so the people who want to start a channel. So I was thinking, I want to start a channel that's really transparent, like pretty much nothing to gain, just spreading honesty and motivating people and giving like a female face to it, because there were loads of awesome female nomads. But yeah, so that was kind of my goal originally with the channel. But it's great now that there's several of other people doing it. I'm definitely not the only female face anymore, and I'm really glad about that.
Well, and that's so true, even with, I think, Udemy and teaching online. Like, I've discovered you because you were the first Udemy course I ever took. And there's not that many females on there as well, especially with the type of courses I wanted to take. So do you see that as a differentiator in a way as well? Or how do you think about that in terms of teaching online?
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought about it because I just – me, so I just made a course and it has my face on it. I haven't thought about whether it made it different, but I definitely thought that a lot of the courses, especially when I started, didn't have people's faces on. They were just their voice with a PowerPoint. And I knew from watching YouTube that it's so much nicer to learn from someone who's actually talking to the camera. And I also realized that that was kind of my special skill. You know how when something comes easy to you, you don't revalue it? And I knew that I was good at talking on camera. I was really relaxed on camera. I'm like a natural teacher. I'm a natural speaker. I love presenting. I love like getting up on stage and talking to a crowd. And most people hate that stuff. So I was like, okay, this must be valuable because this is something people hate and it's something I love. So I always knew that that was a big selling point of my courses, is that I was just happy to be like fully on camera and relaxed and chatting and teaching to people.
And do you remember the first course that you started teaching on Udemy? Was that part of your digital nomad transition?
Yes. So I had never heard of Udemy. And like I said, I moved to Chiang Mai. I had no clue what I was going to do. I had, to my eyes, no skills. Like, I'll just have to think of something. And my plan was just to talk to as many people as possible and just ask them what they were doing until I found someone who was doing something that I wanted to do, because I didn't even know what the options were. So I was like, Louise, you just need to find out the options and then you can choose one of them. And so I spoke to a bunch of different people. I looked at doing dropshipping. I looked at doing voiceovers. I looked at doing Amazon, like so many different things, blogging, freelancing. I did a little bit of freelancing just to kind of keep money coming in. But as soon as I met someone doing Udemy, I was like, ooh, I could do this. Like, I have a YouTube channel, I have a camera, I have a microphone. I like teaching. But my biggest concern was, what am I going to teach? Because I'm like 19 years old, or actually, no, I guess I wasn't 19, I was like 22. But yeah, I was like, you know, what do I know about? And I met this girl, Larissa, who was like, you should do a course about fashion. And I was thinking, well, I'm not a professional fashion stylist. I have no qualifications. Like, who am I to talk about fashion? And she said, let's do one together, all about just styling yourself. So it was called, I think it's called Everyday Fashion for Everyday Women or something. And it was just like, looking into your wardrobe and choosing something to wear. It's not for a photo shoot. It's not for your wedding day. It's just like learning to mix and match colors and shopping for your shape and shopping for colors and just loving your wardrobe and kind of finding a style that suits you. And she was like, we'll film it together. I'll walk you through everything of how to do Udemy, how to upload and how to edit, and then you can see if you like it. So we made that course together and I was just totally hooked. So then I just was like, okay, I'm going to run with this and I'm just going to make more courses.
That's so amazing that she mentored you.
I know.
Because I think that there's such a big barrier of getting started. And that's what I loved about your course, because very meta here, it was how to launch a Udemy course.
Yeah.
But you kind of mentored me in a way. Like, it sounds like that's what she has done for you. That's amazing.
Yeah, she totally changed my life, because I don't think I would have made a course without her, because I was thinking, like I said, I have nothing to teach. And also, I didn't know how to make a course. And I don't think at the time there was Udemy courses about how to make courses. Now there's loads. But yeah, she totally walked me through it and she totally changed my life. Absolutely.
That's amazing. And you have more than 20 courses now on Udemy. You've had over 60,000 people take your classes. There must have been some flops in
Yeah.
Like, was there any courses that you're like, this is going to be amazing, printing money, and it was just crickets?
Yeah, totally. Well, I made one about badminton because I went onto Udemy and there was zero courses. And I was like, well, badminton is a big thing. Like, lots of people do this at the gym as a hobby and there's no courses. I could be the course for badminton. I was like, this is so cool. You know, sports, it's like such a big fitness. There's this huge industry. People make loads of money from fitness. And I think I've made like $10 ever. And what I realized is that if there's nothing, then you don't really want to be the first one. You want to be the best one out of like 50, but you do not want to be the first. So now I would never make a course if there's not like several pages of results and several courses which have got a lot of reviews, but I think I can compete in some different way.
Okay, that's such a good tip, because you would think the opposite, right? You might go on there and you see, oh, there's already so many courses about this. It's too late. What's even the point? But you say that's a good sign.
Yeah. And there's a balance, of course. Like, you don't want the top course to have 10,000 reviews and you're like, well, I'm never going to get that many. If you're looking on the first page and, you know, the top course has got a couple of hundred, but the second course has only got like 20 and you can easily be on page one, ideally in kind of the top half, then you're like, okay, we can work here. Or maybe the first few courses are all by someone who's not native English, or maybe they're all the PowerPoint style, like I said before, where it's not the person's face, or maybe they're not quite the same topic as you, they're not as practical, or whatever your angle is. But yeah, I think there's a balance between areas where you just can't compete and areas where it's like way too dead.
Got it. And how would you say, how important would you say is equipment and the quality of the videos? Because yours is definitely very high quality course. You've got great lighting, everything is consistent, it sounds great, and that makes sense. You had a successful YouTube background, you had this equipment. Do you think that's a requirement? Or like, what would you say to someone who doesn't necessarily have that expertise?
So I think the number one thing you should invest in is a microphone. And that doesn't have to be a lot of money, like, you know, $100, maybe $200, you can get a really good microphone. And you presumably already have a laptop, so that's cool. You just plug the microphone into your laptop. And then the camera, I would suggest, I think some people have used their like Mac webcam or, you know, an iPhone 10 or whatever. I think you could do it with those, but probably you know someone who has a camera. And because I recommend doing all your filming in one day, like block filming it, you can probably find someone who will lend you their camera for a day, possibly even lend you their mic. Maybe you won't have to buy anything. But if you do have to buy something, I really think the mic is the most important, because the sound is what Udemy are quite fussy about. They might reject your course if the sound isn't very good, but it's also what students are most fussy about in my experience. And if you're really struggling with the camera, then you can do the PowerPoint voiceover style, but with like a small video of you in the bottom corner. So then you could just do that on a webcam or something not as high quality, and it wouldn't matter because your video is just small. So yeah, for me, microphone is the number one investment and everything else is kind of optional. But mostly I reckon you could probably borrow from someone if you're really keen on making a course.
Okay. How long does it take you to make a course?
So it takes me about a week, I think, but it's probably not all condensed into a week. So I reckon I spend a day planning, probably a day filming, then maybe like 3 days editing. So we're up to five, and then a day uploading and a day marketing. So it's about 7 days, like, you know, about 50 hours probably. I think that's probably on the fast side. I think most people, let's say you'll take twice as long as that, but that's how long it takes me, kind of as a guide for people, about 50 hours.
And putting yourself online this much, you know, the screen is full of you in the Udemy course. Yeah. I've seen your YouTube videos. It's all Louise. It's all digital nomad girl. What's that been like? Like you said, it comes very naturally and you definitely have a great personality and vibe for on camera, but I'm sure there's some nervousness, especially at the beginning. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that that's something that some people might have as preventing them from doing this as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get worried about being on camera. And the main reassurance that I give people is that it should be less scary than talking to someone in real life, because you can edit it. So, you know, if you accidentally spit or a huge bogey falls out your nose or you fall off your chair or like any of these things, or you like let out a burp, I don't know, all the things that you think could go wrong, you can just press stop and start again. So you actually have the like ultimate ability to turn back time, which I feel like is really reassuring. But I think people do get quite scared, like looking down a camera. So you do kind of have to remember that there's students at the other end of the camera. You just can't see them right now. But it helps a lot if you're talking, feel like you're talking to another human. And I know as a student, you can really tell when the person is relaxed and just like chatting to you as if you're in the room, even though they're just talking to a camera. So I guess my main advice is that it's just practice. And everybody, you know, even me, I was always really happy on camera, but now when I look back, I can see that I've improved a lot as well. So it is a skill, it is practice. You know, you wouldn't expect just to be an amazing dancer the day you step up on the dance floor, but I think it helps. There's a few tricks like that, like trying to remember that you can always delete it. But mostly you have to just put yourself out there, even if you don't feel like you're quite ready, because you'll never feel totally ready. So you have to just get moving.
What about online trolls? Because I think I saw you post on Instagram maybe a month ago. Someone left you a nasty comment on one of your YouTube videos. How often does that happen?
I'm pretty lucky, actually, and I don't get that much negativity. I reckon I get less than one a day, for sure. I reckon I get, you know, maybe one a week. And I'm really fortunate. I think for the size of my channel, most people probably get more negativity than that. But yeah, people love it when I share it on my Instagram, because normally I have some really sassy reply. I get quite into my like sassy replies, and I get loads of interaction when I share it on Instagram. I guess people like to see kind of behind the scenes. And it's a shame that the internet has this like negativity and people kind of hiding behind the keyboards. But I am lucky I don't get lots of it. And I'm reasonably thick skinned. I'm kind of aware of all the old sayings of, you know, they're just unhappy. And mostly I feel bad for them. But sometimes they do get under your skin, of course.
Of course. Well, that's good that you don't get too much of it, because I did see that and I was like, oh, that's so awful.
I know. I normally find they're just misinformed. Like quite often I can see their point of view and I'm like, I see why you feel like that. And in my opinion, you're wrong, but I get it. So yeah, sometimes they're kind of constructive, but a bit negative. And, you know, that's okay. It's a free world. Sometimes they're just negative, but I don't get too much of that. I'm pretty lucky.
Okay, good. Well, I'll definitely include all the links so that people can watch some of these YouTube videos or even take your Udemy courses. You've done such a great job with it.
Yeah, I'd love that.
A question I like to ask everyone who comes on my show, though, is do you see yourself as unemployable now? Like, you've been full-time Udemy, full-time digital nomad, full-time YouTube creator. Can you see yourself going back to England or settling down with the dog and getting a like a 9-to-5? Or how do you think about that?
I know. Well, it's been kind of a roller coaster for me, I guess, because at the start, when I first became a nomad, I used to worry a lot about becoming unemployable. I guess in my mind, I was thinking they were kind of diverging paths, and I was choosing this nomad path, which meant that I was closing off the door to the employed path and no one would want me. And I used to worry a lot about that. And then with time, I realized actually, I was like highly employable because I had so much experience. I'd done so many different things. My CV would really stand out. I was really motivated. And so I was thinking like I could easily walk into some job back home. And I think the only part that you're lacking is I don't have, you know, 3 years of marketing experience or 3 years of HR experience, because I've kind of been doing such a mixture of things. So you're a bit of an oddball, but I'm pretty confident that I could go and get some awesome job in England because I have such an unusual resume now. But actually, just the past couple of weeks, I've realized that it might not be that they don't want me. It might be that I don't want them.
Totally.
And I think I would quite struggle now to get into a job. I used to think that kind of grass is greener idea of like, oh, actually, it'd be quite cute where, you know, it's people's birthdays and you bring in cake and you have friends that you see every day and have all the great things about a job.
Work attire.
Yeah, exactly. I've got my little cubicle with like plants in it. But I'm starting to realize that I don't want that. And as my friends are getting later into their careers, I think they're reaching that point where they're supposed to be at their vision. So you kind of think when you're first starting out, you're like, oh, it's tough now, but it'll get better. And it's still tough. And I'm kind of thinking like, wow, I'm really glad that I have more options than that. And also your income at the start, when you're self-employed, you generally lag behind your friends in jobs. You know, it takes a while to take off, but then once it does, you just whiz past everybody else. So now there's no way I would get a job because I'd have to take such a crazy pay cut. So I think you have to be quite strong-willed at the start, where you're making less than everybody and you had job offers in England maybe that you're thinking like, I turned those down and now I'm working all these hours and not making any money. And you have to just really stick with it, because the growth is not linear when you're self-employed. It's very exponential, so it can be quite scary and everybody thinks that you're just this like traveling bum and you've got no money and you're going to be a backpacker forever. And then suddenly things start to grab and you start to learn how entrepreneurship works. And so now, I mean, I can't imagine ever going back. I think I'm definitely unemployable.
Yeah, I definitely don't. When I ask that question, I don't assume like you can't get a job. It's like, do you even want that anymore?
But it used to be a big worry for me that I couldn't get a job. That was a big problem when I first became a nomad. I was thinking I'm making a diverging path and it's going to be a problem. And turns out it's not.
No, that's how I worry about the podcast, right? I'm the poster child now for I don't want a job and freedom and work on your own terms. It's like, that doesn't sound like a great employee. Maybe they wouldn't want me after this. Maybe I have to take it offline. But no, I think you're so right about at the beginning, you have to make these sacrifices. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been living minimally. I don't know if your friends would let me in their club if I'm minimal enough, but I definitely have had to make those sacrifices at the beginning. And I've been doing it now for 2 years, and you really just start to pick up momentum as you do with anything, right? You just have to stick with it at the beginning. So that's such great advice.
Totally.
Cool. Well, this has been so much fun. I like to end every interview with some speed round questions. And I made some just for you. And there's no right or wrong answer. You just kind of like say the first thing that comes to mind. How does that sound?
Okay. I'm down.
Okay, here we go. Hotel or Airbnb?
Airbnb.
Backpack or suitcase?
Suitcase.
When you're in a dorm, top bunk or bottom bunk?
Top.
Oh, nice. Sorry. Most people would say bottom.
I don't want someone to fall on me in the night. Are you crazy?
Eye mask or earplugs?
Eye mask.
Podcasts or audiobooks?
Podcast.
What's the most intimidating city you've been to?
Probably Hong Kong.
Mm. City you've had the most fun in?
Maybe Amsterdam? Mm.
City that's still on your bucket list?
Seoul.
Okay. Something you wish you had packed in your suitcase right now or backpack?
My favorite comfy but glamorous black culotte trousers.
And something that you probably didn't need to bring?
Half my wardrobe.
Also true. And favorite podcast other than the Freedom Lifestyle, of course?
I really like one called The Hilo Show.
Well, thank you again for coming on the show. It's amazing to chat with you, Louise, digital nomad girl.
Thanks so much,
it's been awesome to hear someone's perspective 5 years in. I think a lot of people I meet are new to it, and that's the category I fall into. So there's only so much advice I can share with my 2-ish years of experience. So thank you so much for making time so late at night. It's early for me, but late for you.
Yeah, well, I'm loving it. Everyone is so welcome in the Nomad Club. And don't underestimate yourself. 2 years is a long time. Most people are still at like minus 1 month and they're thinking, I'm going next month and what's it going to be like? So I'm sure people really appreciate your podcast.
Thank you for saying that. And thank you again. We'll make sure we include all the links.
Woohoo! I'll see you guys later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning into this episode. Please give Digital Nomad Girl a follow on Instagram. She shares amazing tips on this lifestyle. She has the most drool-worthy Instagram feed ever. It'll totally give you the travel bug. And she's just an amazing, genuine person. So give her a follow. If you love these episodes and you know someone who wants to become a digital nomad, please do send them this their way. Send them a screenshot, send them the link, and just get this on their radar, because as long as people keep showing up, I'll keep talking. Thank you again. If you want to pick up my online course, it's launchapodcast.com. Until next time, enjoy your freedom.